There's no finer place to hear chamber music in the summertime in America. There really isn't. When everything is going well, it's just perfect. And I've had musicians from some of the greatest string quartets in the world tell me that.
On this week's Cats Cast, an historic Catskills concert hall and the 70th anniversary of a groundbreaking composition that premiered there. Cats Cast was voted number one regional podcast in this year's Reader's Choice Chronogrammies. There's a new show every 2 weeks on your favorite podcast platform or at catscast.com, where you can join our mailing list, buy a hat, or even make a donation to help keep this show going strong. And if you're already a fan, please help spread the word by giving us a rating and by showing friends and family how they too can tune in for the best audio stories from the Catskills. And now to Woodstock, New York, and a storied concert hall in the forest.
I'm Alexander Platt, and I'm the music director of the Maverick Concerts. And we are here in the truly historic 1916 Maverick Concert Hall, which is basically a chapel in the forest just outside of the town of Woodstock, New York. As has been said, the most famous small town in America. And we're just outside of that hustle and bustle, and we really go back to an earlier Woodstock. We are really at the site where you might say that Woodstock really all began. The Maverick Colony goes back to 1905, 1906. That was when Hervey White, who really was kind of like the Walt Whitman of Woodstock, New York, this very eccentric figure who dreamt of being part of a utopian community in the Catskill Mountains. He was originally part of the Birdcliff Colony. But there was a very famous defection. Ralph Whitehead and Hervey White were very, very different people, the former being a very wealthy kind of Anglophile gentleman, and Hervey White being a poor kid from Kansas who lived hand to mouth. And he quickly just fell afoul of the Birdcliff scene, which was very, in its way, very elitist. I mean, they wanted to have a utopian community in the spirit of William Morris and, you know, all the great arts and crafts artists and their work of that era. And Hervey White was truly utopian in a more kind of socialist manner. Birdcliff, like the Maverick, exists to this day. Birdcliff is a wonderful, fabulous institution. We consider them our sisters, and we love Birdcliff. We get along very, very well. But things were very different in 1905. And then so Hervey White had just, in an age in which, let's just say, open land in Woodstock was not quite as expensive as it is now, he just kind of found a way to buy himself land in this forest just outside of Woodstock Village. And he would just entice artists to come up from New York and spend the summer here. The summer of 1915, there are competing explanations, both of which might be true. There was a drought, and he needed to dig a well to provide water to his artists. So he needed to raise money. So he decided to have a music festival, and this was a strictly classical music festival. The other reason to have the festival, although apparently there are people who dispute this, was to raise funds for Belgian war refugees, because this is the era of World War I, and we all wanted to help gallant little Belgium. And as it turned out, several of the founding musicians of the Maverick were actually of French-speaking Belgian descent. So whatever the reasons or the predominant reasons, this festival was a huge success, huge financial success for Hervey White. So Hervey White then had the idea of establishing a permanent summer music festival on this site. And in the spring of 1916, as soon as the snow had melted, he and several of his friends set about building the Maverick Concert Hall. And they did so with basically nothing but their bare hands and an expertise of architecture and engineering that came from looking at an old, like, coffee table book of drawings of French cathedrals, which is why we have these kind of Gothic arches, if you will, and the very rustic Gothic arches, and we have this equivalent of like a stained glass window or like the rose window of a cathedral. And remarkably, miraculously, the building didn't fall down. One of the reasons why we need financial support and we need to charge real money for tickets is because this is not your typical summer chamber music festival that takes place, oh, I don't know, on the campus of a local college or university. The vast, vast majority of summer music festivals don't have the physical plant challenges of the Maverick. So we have to spend a lot of money every year on keeping this place from falling down. And we do. The acoustics are perfect, especially for piano and strings. No one quite knows why. It may be because the north-facing wall, the planks of wood, you can see daylight through them, whereas the planks on the opposite wall are sealed. And so that may have something to do with it. Maybe the fact that, as you know, this is a hall built entirely of wood, that certainly helps. And we have not adorned it at all. There are no carpets, there are no tapestries. The wall behind the stage is bare, basically. So it is a very austere space, but rich in its wooden building materials. That, along with its chapel-like shape, I think is probably what, to some degree, makes the magic. The Maverick Concerts started in 1916, been going ever since, and the original name was the Maverick Sunday Concerts, because the concerts were strictly on Sunday afternoons, because this was, again, in a time at which there was not only no running water at the Maverick, there was no electricity. So you can only do concerts during the day, and also those were the days when there were no reserve seats, so you simply, in the utopian tradition, you join the line to get your seat. You bought a ticket book. You could either go to 10 Maverick concerts on your own, or you could go to one concert of the Maverick with nine of your closest personal friends. And that made often for a chaotic situation, because we'd literally have no idea as to how many people would show up for a concert. This summer, actually, is the first summer in history where we have no ticket books, in large part because of the COVID pandemic. We switched last summer to an all advanced seating reserved seat system where you buy your tickets online. We still have a box office, and you can still put down a $20 bill and get a seat outside in the benches and have a sublime experience for a sum of money that will not even get you into the parking lot at Tanglewood. And you can hear performances that are very often of the same caliber. So we're very proud of that. The Maverick is always going to be egalitarian, but it cannot be utopian. That's a luxury we can no longer afford. So the concerts are now at 4 o'clock on Sundays, but I made it my mission that we would have something every Saturday night in order to expand the musical palette and expand the audience and expand our imprint in the community. Saturday nights are now a truly eclectic bouquet of jazz and world music, folk music, folk rock, you know, in this kind of Woodstock tradition. Saturdays are just this beautiful, beautiful bouquet of great artistry in many, many fields of music. And then Sunday afternoons are and always will be this kind of, you know, as we say, afternoon with the great masters, this shrine of classical music, most of all for the string quartet. I spend my winter months, not unlike our founder, Hervey White, whose painting you are seeing right behind me, this oil painting portrait of him. Not unlike Hervey White, I spend the winter months somewhere else. Hervey White spent the winters in Georgia. I spend my winters in a place very unlike Georgia, the upper Midwest. I live in Chicago, and I have three what we call small budget orchestras, one of which is a community orchestra, and the other are fully professional regional orchestras in Wisconsin, where I've been involved for just about 30 years now. And I've been a very, very busy freelance conductor. And then just as a kind of fluke, I fell into this job. I mean, we all do this over the course of our careers. I just happened to hear through a friend about a very eccentric but wonderful, small Sunday afternoon chamber music festival in, of all places, Woodstock, New York, and called the Maverick Concerts. I'd never heard of the Maverick. I'd grown up in Connecticut. I'd spent 3 summers at Tanglewood. I'd spent a summer at Norfolk, the summer school for Yale, etc. I had never honestly heard of the Maverick Concerts. And I came up for what was one of a small handful of Saturday night events they were doing then. And it was a concert of actually one of the great Woodstock personalities known to millions in the classical music world, Peter Schickele, a.k.a. P.D.Q. Bach, whose humorous concerts I'd known as a kid. And there he was, here on stage at the Maverick, playing the piano and doing a recital of words and music with his wife, Susan Sindel. And I was just absolutely charmed. I was introduced to some people, and then I heard that they were looking for a new music director because the gentleman who I can now call my predecessor, Vincent Wagner, had very sadly passed away due to the AIDS epidemic. I'm looking at his photograph right now, which I think very appropriately looks at Hervey White's portrait across the width of our music chapel, as we call it. And they were just informally asking around in New York and its environs, you know, do you know of anyone who might be good for this? So my name, I guess, naturally came to the fore, and by the end of that summer, they offered me the job. And it's been one of the great blessings of my life. My first season as music director was in 2003, and with every year, I learn more, and I think I can say I get better and better at doing this, and I just feel in my flower as music director here, and I'm so blessed with a great staff and a great board of directors and one of the best audiences in America. So it's really all apple pie. What's great about the Maverick for me is it allows me to recharge my batteries and be a maestro, be a music director, be the man in charge, but I don't have to physically conduct. I've done so many summer pops concerts. I've done so many outdoor 4th of July things. I've done enough of that. And frankly, with global warming, it's just less of a pleasure to exert yourself that much physically outdoors. I'd rather be hosting a program of chamber music or jazz and let somebody else sweat it up.
And you're not entirely shielded from the elements here either.
Not
this
at all.
Is not,
we are not shielded, which
insulated.
Is, no, this is not an insulated space. It is not a four-season space. I frequently get requests during the intermission of a concert from newcomers to the Maverick and say, oh, I'd love to rent this place out in October. And I say, well, I'm sorry you're out of luck because we have no heat and no AC. During my tenure, we've had some improvements to the physical plant. We're looking up at our beautiful ceiling, which people have told me comparisons from Fijian meeting house to New England congregational meeting house to like a Jewish synagogue in Poland. I've had everything. It's a beautiful ceiling, and it's been beautifully restored over the decades. And we have these big, beautiful fans, these ceiling fans that cool things down quite efficiently. And then we also have modern, eco-friendly bathrooms. When I arrived in 2002, we had outhouses at the Maverick, and that was something that needed to change. But we've done it in a completely eco-friendly way, and I'm really happy about that. But yes, the hall itself is pretty much open to the elements. We're looking out at a set of barn doors, which open and close depending on the climate. We still have a situation where, you know, on a Saturday night in very, very late August or early September, near the end of our season, we may close the doors. But otherwise, we just open them up. And then beyond the doors, looking east, we have these beautiful cushioned outdoor benches. On a Sunday afternoon with the birds are singing, or on a Saturday night with the August moon, it's a magical place to experience the concert because we also have a magical acoustic. It's not at all an acoustic loss to sit out in the benches, especially now in these, well, you know, these quasi-COVID times in which we live. A lot of people prefer sitting on the benches. It's a completely natural and very pure space in which to hear fine music. And when all goes well, nuts, when it's not too hot, when it's not too cold. There's no finer place to hear chamber music in the summertime in America. There really isn't. When everything is going well, it's just perfect. And I've had musicians from some of the greatest string quartets in the world tell me that.
After the break, this year marks the 70th anniversary of an unusual premiere at Maverick Concert Hall on August 29th, 1952. But first, a word from our sponsors. Cat's Cast is sponsored by the Hanford Mills Museum. Explore the power of the past as you watch the water wheel bring a working sawmill to life. Bring a picnic to enjoy by the mill pond. For more information about scheduling a tour or about the museum's new exploration days, visit hanfordmills.org or call 607-278-5744. Cat's Cast is also sponsored by the Central Catskills Chamber of Commerce, providing services to businesses, community organizations, and local governments in the Central Catskills region. Follow the Central Catskills Chamber of Commerce on Facebook. You can sign up as a business member and subscribe to a weekly email of local events at centralcatskills.org. Back at the Maverick Concert Hall, I asked music director Alexander Platt about the world premiere of a very unusual composition in August of 1952.
Well, I get asked about this a lot. I get two questions. The two questions I get asked most frequently, one of them being kind of hilarious, is that it'll be usually a Saturday afternoon and the Saturday night artists are rehearsing, and a late model, high-end automobile will roll into the parking lot, and it will usually have Florida license plates, which means it's a rental. And usually a European voice, a voice in a European accent will say, "Is this where Woodstock was?" In other words, is this where the Woodstock Festival took place in the summer of 1969? And I have to always say, no. So it's actually on Max Yasger's farm in Bethel, and just here you go. And I give them some directions. And then the other thing I get asked about very frequently, so is this where, you know, 4th 33 happened? And it's true.
Yeah, this is Kyle Gann. I teach at Bard College. For many years, I was a music critic for the Village Voice, and I've written 7 books on American classical music, and I'm a composer.
For the uninitiated, which I think is a lot of people, what is 433?
433 is a 3-movement piece, and all the movements are silent. That was the original definition. Cage thought about it differently later. But originally, it was a work in 3 minutes for a non-playing pianist. And the 3 movements were marked in the original performance by closing the piano lid, the lid over the keyboard, at the beginning of each movement and opening it at the end. And there's some ambiguity about the length of the movements. On the original program, they were listed as being, first one, 30 seconds, the second one, 2 minutes and 23 seconds, and the third one, 1 minute and 40 seconds. Although later in the published score, they were listed differently.
Tell me a little bit about John Cage and what was the cultural context for his composing this piece.
Cage had been thinking about doing a silent piece for at least 4 years, because he mentioned it in a lecture at Vassar in 1948. And the original impetus for the piece seems to have been a reaction to Muzak, because in 1948 he said he wanted to write a 4.5-minute piece that would be silent, that you could put on a record, because 78 RPM records used back then for Muzak were either 3.5 or 4.5 minutes long. And Cage's generation was horrified by Muzak, as I still am today. It was a huge thing. There was a Supreme Court case trying to get Muzak taken out of public places that failed. He thought, and other musicians of his generation thought, it was kind of a forced listening of music that people couldn't get away from. And he originally thought of making a silent piece the right length for Muzak that you could play and it would cut off the music for 4.5 minutes.
So instead of sitting in the elevator and listening to elevator music, you'd be left with the silence or the natural sounds of the elevator in motion and that kind of thing?
Yeah, the blessed 4.5-minute release from the piped in music. Over the next 4 years, his thinking about it changed quite a bit, and I think he was afraid it was too much of a protest or a joke and conceived negatively, and he had to come up with another way of thinking about it. In the next few years, he got very much into Zen and started thinking about the arbitrary distinction between naturally occurring sounds and music, and he wanted to make a piece of music that would erase that distinction. So when he reconceived it as a Zen piece, I think it gave him the courage to go public with it. The concert at Maverick was a recital by David Tudor, that Tudor had been asked to play, and Cage told Tudor his idea just a couple of weeks before the concert, and Tudor encouraged him to go along with it. So it was performed there on a program of otherwise avant-garde music, kind of unusual for the Maverick, because Maverick's always been a classical music performance space. It was kind of a departure from what people were used to hearing there.
What was the reception to it at the time?
The reception appears to have been pretty noisy, but, you know, it was a very avant-garde program. There were pieces by Cage's friend Earl Brown, Christian Wolff, and Morton Feldman, which were, you know, somewhat chance-influenced and not exactly improvisatory, but they might have turned out different each time. And in the middle of the program was the big 12-tone first sonata by Pierre Boulez, who wasn't well-known at the time. None of these people were well-known at the time. That was a major feat for most people's ears back then in 1952. 12-tone music hadn't been around that long. And so there was probably some resistance already growing up. Apparently, a lot of the audience were vacationing members of the New York Philharmonic. And so they certainly were prepared for classical music, but they probably were not prepared for anything on that program. They sat through it, and then when it came to The Cage, which was the next to last work on the program, the way Cage described it, in the first movement they heard the rustling of the wind in the trees. In the second movement it rained, and you could hear that, and of course the rain falling on the roof of the Maverick concert space. And then in the third movement the audience started getting restless and calling out things and making a ruckus. And in fact, every performance I've heard of 4:33 that divides it into three movements, and they don't always, there tend to be differences in the incidental sounds you hear in each movement. To me, the main purpose of the piece is kind of an act of framing. If you listen to the piece and you notice that there are actually differences between the sounds and movements, that's not a function of the music. That's something your brain is doing as it processes the sound and works it into this three-movement format. So I think it was a way of demonstrating, as Cage said, that when we're listening to music, we think something's being done to us, but we're actually doing something to it.
Was Cage in the audience that night?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, Cage was there. He didn't perform anything. It was all performed by David Tudor.
And it's been performed many times since then, 70 years later.
Oh, yeah.
What motivates a music director to include it in their repertoire, and is there usually some kind of introduction to it, or are audiences still left scratching their heads?
Well, I think by this time, most people who encounter it know what they're going to get. I actually played it on my high school recital, piano recital, in 1973, and I did get up and talk about it beforehand. Maybe I should have had the courage to not do so. But I didn't know if the teachers and my fellow students would think I'd gone mad or what. So I think sometimes people talk about it beforehand, and I think other times they just assume by now it's such a cultural icon that everybody knows what to expect. In fact, the book I wrote about it is for a series Yale did called American Icons, and one of their books is on the hamburger, one's on the Empire State Building, one is on Gone with the Wind, and they wanted to include 4:33. It's kind of a welcoming populist approach to everything about it. When I played the piece in my high school, we listened to the HVAC system, but at Maverick, you have all these wonderful outdoor sounds, and every time I've been there, I've noticed all of the, you know, the wind in the trees, and there are all these different kinds of trees, and you get a wealth of wonderful environmental sounds out there. And I've always thought it was significant that he premiered the piece there because the Hudson Valley is the home to the Hudson School of Painters, and they invented American art by being very attentive to this new landscape that had never been seen in Europe before. And I thought the act of listening to that landscape drew a connection between composing and painting. They invented American painting by looking at the landscape. We reinvented music by listening to it.
Back at Maverick, as rain started pattering on the roof, like it had when John Cage sat in the audience in 1952, I asked Alexander Platt if there were plans for a 70th anniversary 433 performance.
We are foregoing a celebration of that at the Maverick, the next big anniversary. When we get to the 75th anniversary of 433, you're the first to hear this, but we're going to use it as a centerpiece of a summer, the theme of which will be celebrating post-war American modernism.
One more question. What's it like living in the Catskills 3 or 4 months out of every year?
A great, great pleasure, and B, always having to deal with the sadness of having to leave in September, which is such a riotously beautiful time. I have to pull myself away. And hopefully someday soon, I don't have to have that second issue. But that's, again, watch this space.
If you want to squeeze in a performance before the season concludes in early September, you can buy tickets at maverickconcerts.org. Thanks to Alexander Platt. And to Kyle Gann, author of No Such Thing as Silence, John Cage's 433, published by Yale University Press. Our thanks also to the Mountain Eagle for their support. To subscribe, call 518-763-6854 or email mountaineaglenews@gmail.com. CatsCast is a production of Silver Hollow Audio. Check out catscast.com to search all our episodes, make a donation, or buy a Cat's Cast hat, embroidered right here in the Catskills. I'm Brett Barry. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks.